Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Healthcare deductibles seem like they're on an infinite upward escalator. In the past decade alone, the average deductible for single coverage in an employer-provided plan has risen to $1,400 per year. Well, contrast that to the $0 paid by members of a particular Boston area plan. Zero deductible, zero out-of-pocket hospital payments, prescription drugs that range from $1 to $12 max. How did they do it? This hour on Point, life without healthcare deductibles. And you can join us. How high is your deductible? Has it bitten into your or your family's financial safety net? Would you trade your current high deductible plan for a zero deductible health insurance plan if that meant possibly losing access to some hospitals? Join us anytime online on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we are talking about this today because it's the final installment of Noam Levy's multi-part series on high deductible health plans. Noam covers national healthcare policy for the Los Angeles Times, and all year long, he's been publishing his stories on high deductible plans, and we've followed up with conversations here on the program, and we have links to those previous discussions at onpointradio.org. So Noam Levy, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much, Meghna. Good to be with you.
Great to have you back, and happy holidays, happy new year. It seems like we're ending the year with some good news when it comes to health insurance in America.
I hope so.
Well, first of all, before we get into the details of this particular plan that you've written about, just remind folks, give us the lay of the land right now at this moment in terms of how high deductibles are, how fast they've risen, and the impact that it's having on people's lives.
Well, Meghna, as you noted at the top, deductibles have been rising dramatically in this country over the last 10 to 15 years. And this has really been sort of this quiet revolution in health insurance, particularly health insurance that people get through their jobs. So 15 years ago, the average deductible for a job-based health plan for a single person was about $380. Now, as you mentioned, it's up to $1,400, and of course, it's not unusual at all for folks to be in health plans with a $5,000 or even a $10,000 deductible if they have family coverage. Now, we decided that we were going to take a look at what impact this steep rise in deductibles has had. And among other things, we partnered with the Kaiser Family Foundation, a nonprofit based in California, to do a nationwide survey of Americans with job-based coverage. Again, these are not people who are uninsured. These are not people who are so poor that they qualify for government Medicaid coverage. These are people with job-based health benefits, which used to be sort of the gold standard in health insurance in this country. We asked people about their experiences with their health insurance, whether they felt that it adequately protected them or not, to what extent were they burdened by medical bills. And what we found was really chilling, I think. We found a quarter of people in job-based coverage said they or someone in their family had delayed getting medical care in the last year or not filled the prescription because they were worried about the medical bills. We found one in six Americans with job-based coverage said they had to make a difficult sacrifice in the previous year to pay for healthcare. And that included things like cutting back on food and clothing, taking on extra jobs, moving in with friends or family. And again, just to underscore this point one more time, these are people who have health insurance,
right,
who are making these kinds of difficult sacrifices.
So it is clearly having an impact and a profoundly negative impact on many Americans. Many American lives here. And so that's why when you came out with this last installment of the series, it's kind of eye-popping because given that backdrop that you just described, all of a sudden here, And it's in the Boston area. You are writing about a health plan that has zero deductibles and no co-pays either, as far as I can see. So tell us, give us the background of the story. This is a health plan that's coming out of a union here in Boston. We're going to talk to the head of that union in just a couple of minutes. But how'd you discover what's going on with Unite Here Local 26?
Well, so Unite Here Local 26 represents hotel workers in Boston. These are housekeepers. These are people who work in the banquet halls and restaurants of most of Boston's large hotels. And many unions across the U.S. have historically administered their own health benefits for their members. The health benefits are still funded in large part by employers in the way that most of us who work get health benefits. But the labor union administers the plan, which is a slightly different kind of arrangement. It's called the Taft-Hartley plan. These union plans, some of them have historically been able to secure pretty good benefits for their workers, although it has at times come in exchange for wage concessions, where members have had to give up raises or parts of raises in order to fund their health plan. And Unite Here Local 26 was not unusual in this regard, in the sense that they have historically struggled to keep this health plan afloat, in no small part because the cost of medical care in Boston particularly is extremely high. Hospitals across the United States have run up their prices very dramatically over the last 10 to 15 years. But Boston remains one of the most expensive healthcare markets in the country.
Don't I know it?
And there are a variety of reasons for that, not the least of which is that there are, as everyone in Boston knows, a wealth of very highly regarded medical centers that provide cutting-edge medical care that people from around the world come to Boston to get. But if you're a labor union and you're providing health benefits to your members and you can't afford to pay the bills, in some sense it doesn't matter how good the medical care is if people can't access it. And so a few years ago, the labor union decided that they needed to figure out some way to do something different because they were facing another crisis. And they didn't want to give up wage hikes in order to preserve their health benefits. And so they started taking a look at how they could restructure the way that this health plan worked. And what they found was really quite stunning.
Mm. Well, so one of the key things that they did in order to realize this zero deductible plan is they said, look, you know, the Boston area is blessed with a lot of really great hospitals. Some of them are significantly more expensive than others. So it seems like they just said, we're going to create a health plan where you don't have access to those hospitals. And we're talking about, you know, hospitals that are known around the world, like Massachusetts General Hospital. Like you said, people fly in from around the world to get treatment here. So, how they achieved their biggest cost savings?
Yes, but the story is a little bit more complicated.
Sure.
In the sense that they did not go into thinking about this simply saying, well, we're going to cut out the Mass General. They really did their due diligence in terms of looking at where their members were getting medical care and how much it was costing. And one of the things that is now possible in this country, because there's more transparency around prices, not a huge amount, but they were able to compare the per unit cost for a variety of different medical procedures at Boston area hospitals. And they looked at the Mass General, they looked at the Brigham, they looked at Beth Israel Deaconess, at Tufts Medical Center, at Boston Medical Center. And just to give you a one example, what they found was that, for example, a hip replacement at the BID is cost about $28,359. That's the average charge. The comparison for the same procedure, which is not, you know, a particularly complex medical procedure, the comparison at Mass General was $55,000. At the Brigham, it was more than $65,000. And the union started working with the Tufts Health Plan, a nonprofit health insurance plan in Massachusetts, to look at, well, what if we eliminated these very high-cost hospitals from our network? What if we told our members, you can go and get your hip replacement anywhere except for the highest price places, Mass General and the Brigham. And then for pediatric care, they looked at eliminating Children's Hospital in Boston. And they realized that they could save so much money if they did this that they would be able to provide no deductibles for their coverage. In other words, they would make basically medical care free at the point of service for their members. And they also would save so much money that they would be able to secure some pretty sizable wage increases for their members. But the important thing to keep in mind here is that they were not going to simply impose this on their members. They realized that this was a big ask to tell people, you know, you can no longer take your kid to Children's or you can no longer go to Mass General for your care. And they wanted to make sure that their members were on board with this. And so what they did was they took this proposal to their members and they put it to a vote. And there was a campaign, and some people were uncomfortable with making this trade-off. But in the end, two-thirds of the members voted to approve this new health plan that eliminated these extremely high-cost hospitals from the network.
Well, we're going to get more insight into that process when we come back from a break here. But Noam, I just want to underscore what you've reported here, that for Unite Here Local 26 now, their members who, say, are purchasing a family-based insurance plan, their premiums are less than $50 a month. Is that right?
Their premiums are less than $50 a month for a family plan. And compare
for
that to the
plan.
Average nationally, it's $500 a month for a family plan.
So one-tenth of the national average.
One-tenth.
And as you report here, that's allowed members of the union to do things like purchase homes that weren't within their grasp before this plan.
This was, I think, in some ways the most remarkable statistic about this. So in the last 5 years, the hourly pay for a housekeeper at a Boston hotel went from about $17 to $23.60 in 5 years, a 39% jump in just 5 years. That's money in people's pockets.
Well, we are talking about at least one health plan that has zero deductibles, basically zero co-pays, and a premium that's one-tenth the national average, and how a union in the Boston area managed to pull that off. And so we want to hear from you. How are high deductibles having an impact on your life? Would you go for a plan that had a zero deductible if it meant, as we just heard, maybe not being able to go to some of the most famous hospitals in your area? This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about how one union in one of the most expensive healthcare markets in America managed to create a healthcare plan that has a $0 deductible, that has virtually no co-payments whatsoever for its members, and has achieved premiums that are one-tenth the average paid by Americans in employer-based healthcare plans. Now, we are joined today by Noam Levy. He writes about national healthcare policy for the Los Angeles Times. This is the final, his story on this union is the final story in his year-long series about high deductible health insurance plans. And I want to note something here. Noam mentioned that two of the hospitals that this union and its new healthcare, well, newish healthcare plan says that its members can no longer visit or it's not covered by the plan are Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston as well. These are world famous hospitals. They are run by Partners Healthcare. Now, we reached out to Partners for comment. They did not return our calls or emails. Noam Levy also reached out for to Partners for comments for his story, and they did not comment. Noam, just want to put that out there. So we've done our due diligence on that part on our part here, but Partners isn't responding. So let's turn now to Brian Lang, who is president of Unite Here Local 26. He's been president since 2011, and just to remind folks, Unite Here Local 26 represents about 10,000 workers in the hospitality industry in Massachusetts and Rhode Island. Brian Lang, welcome to On Point.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
So first of all, Brian, if you could just take us back a little bit to the story that Noam was telling us about the financial challenges that Unite Here's health insurance plan had been facing before you decided to do to follow this new route.
Okay. Well, it's not in a vacuum. It's we operate in a healthcare system that is broken. And just to give you one example, using our plan is funded. We negotiate with employers to pay on an hourly basis for the plan. In 1999, employers paid $1.99 an hour. By 2011, they were paying $7.20. That's the rate of the inflation of cost. So that's driven by a system that is broken, doesn't work, and Noam's series really, I think, highlights the impact of the broken system on the average person living in this country today. And so we're no different. We've got to operate in this broken system. And as Noam said earlier, what we did was we knew that we couldn't possibly provide the kind of health care that our members deserve without foregoing wage increases, funding the pension. And so we took a hard look at it. And what we discovered was that Partners in particular, but not just Partners, was overpricing what they charged for standard procedures. And they obviously have done a great job at marketing themselves. I call them the Coca-Cola of healthcare in this area. You know, the people pay all kinds of money for sugar water, right? Well, people pay all kinds of money for Partners because they think they're getting something better, when in fact, when you look at the quality measures, the quality scores of Partners compared to other healthcare institutions in the greater Boston area in Massachusetts, they are absolutely no better than any other. So,
can I just jump in here, Brian?
Yeah.
Because obviously Partners didn't send us a statement or a person to respond to this. But given that we're talking about stuff happening in our own backyard, I would just say that I presume Partners would say, Partners Healthcare would say, actually, Massachusetts General Hospital, there's a reason that kings and princesses fly in from wherever they are around the world to get care from some of the most expert, most qualified, most cutting-edge physicians and facilities available anywhere in the world, that they are actually providing a level of care that they see as measurably better. And so, therefore, it justifies the cost. That's one of the things I presume Partners would say.
Well, it's interesting that they won't come on and actually say that and get into a real dialogue and conversation. It makes me skeptical that they can back up a claim like that. I maintain that Partners may have some very specialized procedures that they do that a minority of people who seek health care may benefit from. But when it comes to the standard procedures, the quality measures are out there. There are federal agencies that measure quality, and their quality is no better than BMC, Boston Medical Center, when you get right down to it. And what Partners has done really well is market themselves. A matter of fact, Partners made a nice, handsome profit this past year. I just read it in the paper last week. They're going to take $100 million of that to rebrand. They're a nonprofit, and they're going to spend $100 million of healthcare dollars to rebrand. What's wrong with that?
Well, you know, as much as I wish that Partners were here to answer that question, they're not. So I don't necessarily want to make this hour into a critique of Partners Healthcare. But what I want to ask you is, okay, you see it as a perception, but clearly, and no one was talking about this before the break, many of your members had the perception that there was superior care at Massachusetts General Hospital, at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And I'm thinking specifically Children's Hospital, right? So, you know, I imagine there are your members out there who are saying, well, what if my child, God forbid, but comes down with some cancer? The place you want to send your child in the greater Boston area for that specialized treatment is Children's Hospital, but you were telling them under this new plan, as you know, circa 2013, that wasn't going to be an option. So what I'm trying to get to is how ultimately there was a 2/3 vote in favor of this plan. What did you do to convince your members that this would benefit them in the long run to lose access to those big brand name hospitals?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very emotional issue. You're absolutely right about that. Particularly when it comes to your families, your loved ones, and if somebody is sick, and particularly if they have a serious condition, we all want the best for them. There's no question about that. And in some ways, that's what makes this very difficult, and particularly making this change in this environment where you have a couple of institutions out there that have done such a good job at promoting themselves as the best, the place that you would want your family to go to. And so, interestingly, there was 2/3 of our members did not have to change their providers. 1/3 had to. Isn't that interesting? That's how the vote broke down. That's a big what the people call a disruption. That's a big percentage of disruption. And the vote broke down along those lines pretty much.
Oh, interesting. So you didn't necessarily change a lot of minds at that time.
I'm not sure we did. I think one of the things that we accomplished in the course of the initial discussion within the membership was a recognition of how the healthcare is paid. Mm. Many members just thought, oh, well, I pay my union dues and it covers the health care. Or I pay my $4 a week for my single coverage and that covers the cost of health care. So in the course of this conversation, our members understood that actually $7.20 of their money was going to pay for health care. That's over and above their wage. And so that was very useful because when we negotiate with the employers, we talk about the total package and we talk about how much money do we want to go to healthcare, how much do we want to go to pension, how much do we want to go to wages. And one of the conversations we started to have is there's other statistics out there. If you make more money, you tend to be healthier. You could have a healthier lifestyle.
Right.
And so we started to talk about that. And our members became much more involved in the conversation of what happens when we negotiate with the employers and what's happening with our money that's going to pay for health care. You know how much the employers pay per hour for health care today? $7.28. That's an 8 cents increase since 2012.
Wow.
So not only have our members been able to maintain the most affordable health care in this state with access to many good institutions, the employers are not being overburdened, and our members are making better money, more money going into their pockets, more money going into their pension plan for when they retire.
Interesting. So hang on here just for a second, Brian. Noam, you've been listening patiently here, and I know I'm sure there's a lot that you want to chime in on, but let me just cut to a really important question that's relevant to our national audience here, because, of course, this is happening in Boston, which is On Point's backyard, but I'm thinking about every other place in America, because we, you know, the greater Boston area is blessed with a huge number of, an unusually large number of excellent hospitals. I mean, we've mentioned just five of them out of the many more. This is what I'm wondering. That is not the case in most of the rest of the country. So Unite Here Local 26 had options that perhaps, you know, unions in other places don't have. So how replicable is the health plan that that Unite Here Local 26 has created?
Well, to some extent, you're right. And as a Boston native, I'm happy to say there's no place like Boston, and there's no place that has hospitals like the Mass General or Children's. But it's true that Unite Here was fortunate that Beth Israel Deaconess, Boston Medical Center, Tufts, those are also very top tier medical centers where their members could go. But around the country, it is true that there are often choices that patients have when they go to seek care. This is becoming more and more of a challenge because hospital systems are consolidating. So there are often dominant hospital systems in certain metropolitan areas around the country. And I'm sure it won't surprise you to hear that those are also places where the prices for the medical services those hospitals provide have increased most dramatically.
Right.
But if you go to most large metropolitan areas in this country, there are options. The other point that I think is worth making, which Brian alluded to, is that when you look at quality data and price data, not just in Boston but around the country, one thing that is remarkable is that there is very little correlation between the price that a individual hospital charges and what the quality data suggests about how good that medical care is.
Right, as they say in healthcare, it's the price is stupid, right? In American healthcare.
It is the price is stupid. Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. Well, you know what? There's much more to dig into, but we've got some callers who want to have the questions and comments put to the air. So let's go to Jennifer, who's calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I think one of your guests confirmed that if a patient had a specific, let's say, rare disease and was this union member, they could not go to one of the top-tier hospitals. They would have to go to one of I'll just say for argument's sake, the so-called second-tier hospitals that are in their network. And first question is, isn't this kind of creating a two-tier system of healthcare for people? And it may not affect folks in Massachusetts as much, but I know in other rural places, if this was mimicked in other areas, it might. And second question, I had a relative with a neurological problem, and her doctor absolutely recommended one of the top tier facilities in Boston. What are you doing to convince physicians, if you can, that this is the path that the union members should go? Because, again, it does seem to create a two-tier system. And I will take my answer off the air.
Jennifer, thank you for your call. So Brian, first of all, are hospitals like Children's Hospital just not in the plan whatsoever? Or are they sort of considered out of network? Is that a good analogy? Could a member go there if they wanted?
If there's a specialized procedure that's the only place that it's available, they could go there, and it would be covered by the plan.
If it's the only place.
If it's the only place that does a particular specialized procedure,
okay,
they could. And Just with regard to the two-tier network, no, we don't think there's a two-tier network. We think there's one tier of quality, and the scientific analysis and the data is out there. Mass General is no better than Beth Israel, than Boston Medical Center, than Tufts Medical Center in Boston, than Cambridge Health Alliance in the Boston area. So there's one tier here. There's a two-tier system when it comes to pricing.
Mm. Now, what about Jennifer's really interesting question about primary care, for example, doctors referring people to those expensive hospitals? Because I think connecting with your members with primary care physicians was also a part
yes.
of this effort.
Yeah, that's a good point. One of the other changes that we made that has really made a difference, both in the quality of the health care that our members are receiving and in cost, is that people are required to have a primary care physician. So any primary care physician that our members have knows what the network is and knows where to refer people. And what it's led to is many fewer people using the emergency room as their first stop for health care. And it's proven that you don't get the best healthcare and emergency rooms.
Noam, we've got a minute to go before the break, so I'm going to give you a chance to give us the first part of an answer to a question, because Jennifer mentioned sort of tiers in perhaps in a concerned sense. But as you reported, there are lots of health plans, and this might be something that more listeners are familiar with, where hospitals actually are tiered. Literally, they're tiered by the health plan itself, and you might pay more to go to the higher-tier hospital than you would to the lower-tier hospital. That is not uncommon.
It is. There are some health plans that do that. It is not terribly common, in part because it's quite complicated to actually implement a plan like that. But people certainly would be familiar with HMOs, and HMOs have been out there for decades. Maybe we can get into this after the break, but the HMO philosophy was essentially constraining choice as a way to lower cost. The way that philosophy was implemented 20 years ago created a lot of problems, and I think one of the things that Unite Here did that was so path-breaking was address some of those shortcomings in a very constructive way.
Mm. Well, Noam Levy, National Healthcare Policy Reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Hang in here. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about how one union has managed to keep its health costs or its health insurance costs in check. Their premiums are one-tenth the average that Americans pay for employer-based health insurance. They have a zero-deductible plan. They have virtually no co-pays. Well, how'd they do it? So we're talking this hour with Brian Lang. He's president of Unite Here Local 26. It represents 10,000 workers in the hospitality industry in Massachusetts and Rhode Island. Noam Levy is also with us. He wrote about Unite Here's efforts in the Boston area for a series on high-deductible health plans that he has been reporting for the Los Angeles Times. Now, Noam, before the break, you were talking about Americans' sour feelings about HMOs and back when sort of restricting choice was one of the cost-saving strategies that HMOs followed. So what specifically do you think Unite Here did differently that didn't lead people to have such a negative feeling?
Well, recall that a lot of people, I think, soured on HMOs because they had a sense that they were being told for sometimes baffling reasons that they couldn't take their loved ones to the best place in the world to get medical care. So what? And but I think part of the problem for HMOs, there certainly were those experiences, but workers didn't see any benefit, or oftentimes did not see very much benefit to having any restriction on their choice. So companies would implement an HMO, and they might save some money on it, but those companies would oftentimes just pocket the savings. There also wasn't a very good system in a lot of particularly for-profit HMOs to actually help patients better manage their care so that they were healthier. I think one of the things that the labor union in Boston did so effectively, and Brian alluded to some of this earlier, was one, they showed a very clear financial benefit to patients. So the union members, if they were going to make this choice, they could see a clear trade-off in higher wages, lower in premiums, and lower out-of-pocket medical costs. Mm. So very, very clear financial benefits, money in their pockets. The other thing I think that was so important was, as Brian said, connecting the members with primary care physicians so that there was a feeling that this has some benefit medically beyond just us coming in and telling you, you can't go to this hospital or that hospital.
Right. So let me ask you more about that, because you quote Joey Mokos, a senior official at Unite Here Health. And Joey told you, we had this idea that if we could put more money in our members' pockets, that would do more for their overall health than anything we could do in the health plan. And Brian mentioned this a couple of minutes ago, too. I think that's a pretty profound, I don't want to say insight, but a profound cause for action here. It's one that we don't actually talk enough about in terms of healthcare. That one of the strongest indicators of positive healthcare outcomes is income, quite frankly.
That's right. That's right. And there is more attention now to this, although less so in the health insurance space. And again, I think this is why what Local 26 did was so interesting. There is more talk now about how people's overall health has a relatively little to do with the kind of medical care that they're getting per se. It's obviously very important, particularly if you're extremely sick. But things like how much money you make, what neighborhood you live in, how good is the food that you eat, how much stress are you under, what's your job like, these are what's called social determinants of health. And there is more thought about how we can make our medical system more responsive to those underlying causes of poor health. In extreme examples, we have health plans now talking about funding housing, particularly for homeless patients whose health obviously is highly dependent on them having a safe and healthy place to sleep. But I think this idea, you don't hear this as much elsewhere, this idea that if you raise wages, that has a whole sequence of cascading positive impacts on people's health. You don't hear that very much in the health plan space. But very, very provocative, difficult probably to track academically, but certainly I think makes intuitive sense. And having talked to several of Brian's members in the course of reporting this story, I can tell you that they certainly appreciate the wages and people's ability to live in a healthier place. One of the people I interviewed for this story was able to buy a house in no small part because of the wage increases, which led to a healthier environment for her kids to grow up in. Yeah. I mean, that's hard to measure, but that's pretty real.
Well, let's go back to the calls. Let's go to Maria, who's calling from Montpelier, Vermont. Maria, you're on the air.
Hello, and thanks for taking my call. I'm fascinated by this. It sounds like a great creative approach. And I'll out myself. I grew up in Boston and followed aging family members who remained there after I moved up to Vermont 30 years ago for medical school. My concerns are first that this is a great option, but I don't see it working in rural America, because just to give you a sense of the reality here for us, if you want to get to a tertiary care hospital, and there are two or maybe three that we have access to from Vermont, you might have to drive 2 or 3 hours to get to one. Mm-hmm. So options are pretty much non-existent. Second, with our aging population and our poverty here, our payer mix, which really determines the cost of insurance for those who have commercial insurance, is so poor that as I am buying my health insurance on the exchange, Vermont's exchange, my premiums for an individual with a high deductible plan with an HSA option are about $750 a month. I've chosen that option because a high deductible plan with an HSA is actually the most cost-effective one available.
Uh-huh.
And I'd hate to see it disappear mm-hmm. because not only does it cost me the least of anything I could do, but it's the simplest.
Right.
Well, and for an aging person who may face really serious health challenges without a whole lot of support in terms of someone to deal with the insurance companies when you're going through medical difficulties, once I've paid $3,000 out of pocket for my HSA, I'm done.
Yeah.
And it's all
Marie,
settled.
I'm going to take it back from you there because you've given us a lot to think yeah. about, and thank you so much for your call. Brian, you're nodding your head.
I am. And look, I agree with Maria. I think what we've come up with here is making the best out of a very bad situation in a particular area. I think the situation that Maria just described can't be fixed by what we've done. And quite frankly, we've always at Local 26 said, look, we're trying to stay ahead of the curve in a system that's broken, and we're going to have to continue to innovate. We don't feel like we're at the end of the road here, and I'll get back to that later. But quite frankly, the only way that this insanity is going to stop is with Medicare for All. That's the term. I'm using it now. The Democratic presidential candidates are saying that. But every other developed country in the world has something like that. It takes the profit out of healthcare. It creates more transparency, and it reaches many more people, whether they live in rural America or urban America, whether they're rich or whether they're poor. There is health care for people.
Brian, can I just jump in here? Because I'm really glad you mentioned that. I wanted to ask you again, because this takes us into the national context as well. Because regarding Medicare for All and whatever form of it mm-hmm. one's talking about, it seems as if some of the people who are least enthusiastic about it are your fellow union members. Maybe not here at Local 26, but in other unions in different parts of the country, folks who you know have worked hard and fought hard for their plans and their systems, they see Medicare for All as a potential threat to what they've worked hard and fought hard for.
Well, look, I don't think that's any different than what we faced when we made the shift to narrowing the network here. And quite frankly, some of the people who were the loudest critics when we made the change back in 2013 have come forward and said, you know what? I thought it was wrong. I was ready to kill you as a president. How could you be doing this to us? And now I see that it worked. People fear the unknown, and particularly around health care. And so many of us as union leaders have built our unions around providing affordable health care in the context where so few people have it.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking about changing the context completely. And it's natural for people who have good plans like ours to say, oh, I don't want it to change.
Right.
That's not unusual.
Well, Noam Levy, just today in your very paper in the Los Angeles Times, there was a story about another Unite Here chapter in Las Vegas who I believe they represent some 60,000 culinary workers in Las Vegas, have set up a system there that their employees are really happy with. And they may not be so positive or enthusiastic about the prospect of Medicare for All.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Brian did a better job of explaining it than I certainly could. I think he's absolutely right about that. I think, you know, one of the things which which, you know, I think Local 26's experience gets at is the problem of price in our system. And as Brian mentioned, they found a way to sort of get around that, but their union, as important as the work is that they're doing, is not going to solve the problem of these huge price differences in the cost of medical care. And, you know, it's true that most other industrialized countries address the price problem, whether they do it as a sort of government health plan or do it in a more regulated private environment, as some countries like Germany and the Netherlands do. All of them are getting at this underlying price issue. And because we as a society have sort of been unwilling to kind of address those price issues through government, you know, it's up to unions like Local 26 and the Unite Here union in Las Vegas to sort of come up with these kind of Rube Goldberg kind of solutions.
Well,
and they're temporary. I just want to be clear. They're temporary. Look at what we're facing here in Massachusetts. I'm slamming partners, and I make no bones about it. But what are we facing? Another merger. Leahy and BI, and if that merger goes through, they're going to be larger than partners. And what are they going to create? We're going to have these two mammoth institutions basically dictating healthcare costs. And if anybody thinks healthcare costs are going to go down, they're sadly mistaken. They're only going to go up. And I don't quite frankly know what we're going to do at Local 26 if that happens.
So you're going to have to keep innovating. I hear your call that this is a temporary fix, but have other unions in other parts of the country reached out to you and said, how'd you make this work?
I talk to my counterparts around the country, and in some areas, people are doing similar things, maybe not as drastic as we have done.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things we all pride ourselves in, whether it's New York City, Boston, Washington, D.C., Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, is fighting for and figuring out how to provide very affordable health care for our members.
Well, Noam, we've got about 3 minutes left here, and I wonder if you could take a step back with me, because you have been chin deep in this world of high deductible health care plans for a year now. And I'm just wondering, sort of personally, what are your big takeaways? What are the things that you learned about American health care that you're going to carry forward with you?
That's a good question. I think the one overwhelming takeaway I think that I've had is the amount of hurt that American families, workers are going through right now because of the cost of health care and because of the benefit structure that we have that shifts so much costs onto them. I mean, I talked to, you know, more than 100, 150 people around the country who are living with high deductible health insurance. And this experiment, which is now sort of 15 years on, I think if people don't realize already the incredible toll this is taking on middle-class Americans, working-class Americans, even some higher-income Americans. If people don't realize that now, they really should, because this system, I don't know precisely, Medicare for All is a solution or some other kind of solution. This experiment is not working.
Well, I think perhaps that realization is there because Medicare for All has come out from the shadows as an option which a lot of people are giving serious thought to, Noam. I mean, do you think we've sort of turned a corner in the United States in terms of hoping for what might be or should be possible?
Possibly. I mean, I think certainly Medicare for All is complicated for a whole range of reasons, not the least of which I think Local 26 experienced in terms of people's nervousness about making big changes to their health benefits, no matter how grim their prospects in the immediate future may be. But I'm not sure we have quite gotten to the point of realizing one important part of this story, and that is sort of central to the Local 26 story, which is the prices. Mm-hmm. People, I think, are beginning to realize how much of our healthcare costs and how many of our healthcare problems are driven by the underlying price of what it costs, you know, to do anything in our healthcare system. And that's going to be the thing that will change the equation, I think. I don't know if we're quite there yet, but I do think we're moving there.
Well, Noam Levy writes about national healthcare policy for the Los Angeles Times. He's been reporting all year on the impact of high deductible health insurance plans, and we've talked to him a bunch of times this year. Go to onpointradio.org to listen to those conversations. Noam, thank you so very much for all your reporting.
Magna, thank you for having me.
Brian Lang, president of Unite Here Local 26, representing 10,000 workers in the hospitality industry in Massachusetts and Rhode Island. Thank you as well.
It's great to be here.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.